Okay, comrades, welcome to this educational hosted by the Democrats. What we're going to do, what we always do, we have a two-point agenda, but we'll probably just record the first one, which is the actual topic of the discussion, which today is about Joseph Seymour's 1977 essay called On Bourgeois Class Consciousness, which I think is a significant work, but I've prepared the presentation on it, so if comrades are okay, I'll go straight into that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The essay that this educational is about was a seemingly abstract commentary made by Joseph Seymour, who was a key intellectual figure of the Spartacist League of the U.S. in the mid-70s. Now, I mean, the Spartacists, the old Spartacists, I should probably call them, were a contradictory political trend with roots in both of the two major trends in the US that emerged from the Trotskyist movement in Trotsky's day. Go into some of the history and what I'm talking about. Somebody has got a... Somebody mute themselves. I can hear a...
Matt?
Yeah, I've done it now. The US Trotskyist movement had been founded in the late 20s by three prominent members of the US Communist Party, James P. Cannon, Martin Ahern, and Max Shachtman. And they founded the US Left Opposition and its various successor organizations, which eventually and most notably became the US Socialist Workers Party. They always worked very closely with Trotsky and carried out many of the tactics of the Trotskyist movement in the years before the founding of the Fourth International in 1938. This grouping, it did serious work in the trade unions. In 1934, its trade union militants led the Teamsters or Truckers Strike in Minneapolis, which was one of the three major strikes that year that were led by communist groups in the period of the revival of the workers' movement after the worst of the Great Depression. And it carried out a short-term entry into the Socialist Party in 1936 to 1937, which enabled it to fuse with a layer of younger militants. So in some ways, the American SWP, which is 1,000 or so people, became the leading party of the Fourth International when it was founded in 1938. And their geographical closeness to Mexico was a real advantage in collaborating with Trotsky in his final exile. And they were also subjected to the pressures, of course, which the whole of the movement was subjected to. Because of the relatively open situation that they lived in, these issues were fought out pretty openly, really, in the open. So, I mean, an important example is the Stalin-Hitler Pact in 1939 caused splits in the Trotskyist movement. There was a wave of hysterical Stalinophobia that equated Stalin's regime with Hitler, swept the labor movement in the imperialist countries. And in the United States, a faction led by Max Shachtman, Martin Ahern, and James Burnham, who was an academic figure, was formed within the American SWP, which abandoned defense of the Soviet Union against imperialism. And by the end of that dispute in 1940, it went on for about a year and over a year, Shachtman had developed the theory of bureaucratic collectivism, the USSR as a new class society that was neither capitalist nor socialist, but in fact his view was it was worse than capitalism. Whereas Cannon, James Cannon, and the trade union cadre, the core of the SWP, joined with Trotsky to defend the USSR as a degenerate workers' state. And those issues were fought out comprehensively. There are two important books available on this. There's one by Trotsky called In Defense of Marxism, and one by James P. Cannon called The Struggle for a Proletarian Party, all centered on that fight with Shachtman and Burnham. Mainly. In 1940, Trotsky was assassinated, and the Trotskyist movement had to confront World War II without Trotsky leading them, without his insights. There's a complex sequence of events in World War II that led to the defeat of Nazi Germany and its allies, Italy and Japan, primarily by the USSR in alliance with the US, with Britain and France sort of secondary in tow behind them. And the situation after the war was a bit of a mess, because the Stalinists defeated Nazi Germany, but they also made sure that the working class, as an independent class, didn't come to power anywhere. Whenever the working class threatened to come to power directly, the Stalinists united with imperialism to crush it, most notably in Europe, in France, in Italy, in Greece, and in Vietnam, actually, with the Saigon Workers' Insurrection in 1945, which the Stalinists joined directly with French imperialism to suppress it. But there was also the unstable phenomenon of the creation of deformed worker states right across Eastern Europe, in China, in other places like Vietnam and a number of places, really. And the Trotskyist movement was disoriented by the creation of those states without the conscious action of the working class. But at the same time, the imperialists were implacably hostile to the Soviet Union's victory and to those new deformed worker states, and they set up NATO as an aggressive instrument to fight them, and so began the Cold War in the classic sense. And after the war, without Trotsky's guidance, the Trotskyist movement, partially capitulated to Stalinism, and some began to hail bureaucratic Stalinist leaders as revolutionaries and sort of build the illusion that they would lead the world revolution, whereas others followed in the footsteps of Chapman and just capitulated to imperialism. And there was little coherent understanding of what had happened. There are a lot of very, very complex and confused debates, in my view, And the Spartacists represented one fragment of those debates. They got probably the trickiest question of all right. That was Cuba, the nature of Cuba. And they're getting that right ought to have laid the basis for resolving all those problems, I would have thought. But in fact, that was not to be. But just to recap on that, I mean, Fidel Castro and his guerrilla movement came to power in 1959 and overthrew a classic UN, US-backed neo-colonial tyranny. And then they proceeded to nationalize virtually the entire Cuban economy to preserve themselves from being overthrown by the Cuban bourgeoisie, who simply worked with US imperialism. And some Trotskyists, including the aging, leaders of the US SWP, and it was getting on a bit by then, they hailed Castro as an unconscious Marxist, an unconscious Trotskyist, and a world revolutionary effect. Whereas others on the Trotskyist left, they tried to deny that there'd even been a revolution in Cuba at all. And the Spartans actually got this right, and they understood that while Cuba was a workers' state and had expropriated capitalism, it was a deformed workers' state that needed a supplementary political revolution to bring the working class to genuine political power. You see, the thing is that Castro had come to power at the head of a movement that was not initially communist, even in name. He was actually a liberal who had emerged from what was called the Ortodoxo Party in the early 50s in Cuba. And yet in power, his July 26 movement changed its ideology to match what it had actually done, and it joined the Soviet bloc, declared itself a communist party, etc. So I think that they understand they understood that the what the understanding that they developed clarified what a deformed worker state actually was, that such states have been generally created by communist movements that had abandoned the working class, that based instead on an oppressed peasantry, and that these parties have become petty bourgeois nationalist parties in effect. And but when the working class was politically paralyzed and under extreme conditions of imperialist oppression, such movements proved capable of overthrowing capitalism and creating such worker states. but with a fundamental weakness, which was later to destroy most of them. And what was clarifying about Castro is that, of course, he wasn't initially even claimed to be a communist, but his movement was in effect the same thing, you know. After that was a anti-working class bureaucratic regime committed to socialism in one country, similar to the USSR under Stalin and since. And that was actually a very perceptive and thoughtful analysis that no one else at the time developed, you know. So what, going on to what the Spartacists became, they, you know, in the decades to come, they used this to argue that they were the continuity of Canon's SWP in its best period that was created under Trotsky's guidance. And therefore, they were the only real Trotskyists in the world. That was their argument. And this had some apparent credibility in their earlier period, but it was incorrect. It was a conceit based on a partial understanding that slowly drove them mad, actually. It was wrong because they were rooted in both strands of the pre-war Trotskyist movement. The founders of the Spartacists, particularly Robertson, but also Wolfert, who played the key role in the creation of the Cuba analysis and the creation of their trend, actually, came from Schachmann's anti-Soviet Workers' Party, so-called Workers' Party, not from the SWP. And what happened is in the mid-50s, they joined the SWP when it was getting on a bit and it was moving gradually to the right. They joined it on the basis of a sort of left-wing impulse, really, of being one to Orthodox Trotskyism on the Russian question. And, you know, and when the SWP changed its view of Cuba or capitulated to Castro, they were thrown out because they argued their position, you know, that Cuba was a deformed workers' state. But the problem is that Robertson, who became the leading figure, although he had broken from Schachmann over the Russian question, had not questioned another aspect of Schachmann's politics, his left Zionism. And as part of their right-wing evolution at the beginning of the Cold War, the Schachmannites had supported the creation of Israel. And that was a key aspect of their ideology. There are documents on this which I could refer to, but I won't go into it in detail here. So in the coming decades, the Spartacists produced some very orthodox material on the Russian question that was given a lot of weight by their correct understanding of Cuba and the whole question of deformed worker states. For instance, their opposition to Soldanovsk in the early 80s, I think, was very, very good, you know. But it was mixed up with material on Israel, Palestine and things like that that were completely wrong, you know. They earlier had a position that it was correct to side with Israel in the 1948 war. They changed it in the 70s, you know. They actually had a similar approach to the Irish question. It was actually an extension of that, actually, an extension of the same approach. So in 1969, they actually called for a socialist independent Ulster in the situation after during the civil rights movement period. They were sort of pro-unionist in a funny sort of way, you know. I mean, later they modified their positions to be effectively neutral in these national struggles, calling on Arab and Jewish workers in Palestine or nationalist and unionist workers in the north of Ireland to abandon their national struggles and unite with each other. Not really much of an improvement, in my view. They were a perplexing phenomena because they were partly right and partly severely wrong, which is actually very damaging, you know. I mean, there is an old saying that a half-truth is more damaging than an outright lie. And that contradiction gave rise to an organisation with a strange and damaging way of working, which is a reflection of their political contradictions. But at the same time, they are capable of great insight. And this is where Seymour's article comes in. You know, I think it's a startling example of their ability to provide insight. Because Seymour's article completely steers clear of any superficially complex colonial questions. It leaves that aspect of Spartacist politics completely alone. That's its strength. Instead, it deals with the problem of how the class consciousness of the imperialist bourgeoisie works. And it attacks some misconceptions of this that are common on the left. What Simo does is he contradicts different concepts of left reformism about how capitalist society works. What he says, the structural concept and the conspiracy concept, or the conspiratorial complex concept. So, for some reformists, capitalism is purely a matter of structure. All you have to do is change the structure, and society will improve incrementally. And there's no sense in this ideology that there are real material interests that dictate these structures, i.e. property relations that reflect the interests of a specific layer, the capitalist ruling class. And then there's the other view, which is that capitalism itself works through a series of conspiracies, and the job of socialists is therefore to combat and expose the conspiracies. And that may seem very radical, but it's actually flawed, and it can also lead to a pessimistic view. And there are a lot of those concepts around right now, actually, both on the left and on the right, in different forms. For instance, you hear people who attack, you hear those who attach great importance to things like the World Economic Forum, who are seen as so advanced and the real rulers of the world, somewhat different to the ruling class itself. An earlier example of this is the whole series of similar theories about the Bilderberg Group, and such like. There's the theory of the Great Reset, which is linked to theories about the World Economic Forum and presupposes some demonic scheme. There's a left-wing variant of this, which the Great Reset involves destroying all previous gains of the working class movement. The right-wing variant of this is about the replacement of the population of the imperialist countries with immigrants. There are two different versions of it. But both of these found common ground in various theories about the COVID pandemic, that this was part of some sinister scheme to do one or the other of these things, according to the particular leaning of those who were formulating the theory. And I'd argue that blurred that was really quite important in blurring the difference between left and right. And it has to be said that as their organization collapsed in around 2020 and then created a new leadership pretty much from scratch, the Spartacists seemed to go through some strange political and psychological process where they, for a while, seemed lost in paranoia about the COVID pandemic. But anyway, going back to Seymour, he points out that the bourgeoisie does not have the level of coherence that such theories imply. And that these various think tanks are actually partial. They're the brainchilds of various bourgeois milieu who are themselves fallible and capable of misunderstanding reality as much as any other group of bourgeois ideologues. And if your worldview is that the class struggles depends on who can organize the most effective conspiracies, it's not a huge step from this to the view that the bourgeoisie is too clever and capable of organizing conspiracies to actually be overthrown. So that leads by a different route to submission to bourgeois authority. And instead, what you get is attempts to convince the bourgeoisie to mend their ways, which is, of course, another form of reformism, in other words. And we do, as monopoly capitalism has got more and more concentrated. And firms connected by neoliberalism, venture capital, banking, etc., financialization are getting more and more powerful. We see more and more of these theories emerging. And it's all over the place. There are examples that exist of a worldview where capitalist society can, as Seymour says, jump over the law of value. I think modern monetary theory is a bit like that. It's the idea that currencies are almost, certainly fiat currencies are almost infinitely expandable, providing they can be kept essentially separate from other currencies. I think ultimately that contradicts the law of value. And the point that Seymour makes is that the bourgeoisie are not conspiratorialists who run the world according to a plan. They're not Marxists in reverse. And Seymour is actually very much in pains to emphasise this. Their real aim is to realise surplus value, or to put it more simply, to make profits. And they're quite capable of forming factions on a large or small scale to do each other down, or to crush each other, or even an extremist to slaughter each other via mobilising their workers into imperialist wars, if they feel it necessary from their own particular standpoint. You know, their ideology is not Marxism looked at from the other end of the telescope. They don't apply reverse class struggle concepts in any scientific manner to the class struggle from their side. Individuals may boast of doing such things, but bourgeois class war tactics are empirical, and they may undermine their own interests in the future. An example of that is Margaret Thatcher's destruction of heavy industry in Britain, which was straightforwardly done to undermine what was in the 70s the strongest trade union movement in Europe. And it succeeded. It succeeded undermining that movement. But in doing so, it accelerated Britain's decline as an imperialist power enormously. And something similar happened in the US. Much productive capacity was outsourced to China and other low-wage countries to cut down on labour costs. And China gained a lot from that. And now all factions of the American bourgeoisie regard China as a major threat. But how did it become a major threat? Largely through that outsourcing process. That is not smart. That is not the bourgeoisie being smart at all. And the bourgeoisie persists in this behaviour. It cannot do otherwise. This is how it thinks. This is the point that Seymour is making, that social being determines social consciousness. Various ex-Marxist ideologues have chided the bourgeoisie with such short-sightedness. Like, you know, I mentioned even earlier James Burnham, who after he broke from the SWP, he moved rapidly to the right, away from Marxism, to becoming a right-wing Cold War militarist. And he wrote a book called The Suicide of the West. And what did Seymour said about it? He said it was designed to prove that the dominant political attitudes of the American ruling class were optimistically false. And he was ignored, and in part he was ridiculed, actually. I mean, the bourgeoisie is episodically capable of class unity when confronted with a potent threat from the working class. But that unity rarely lasts long, and even within such circumstances, they try to do each other down. You know, Seymour gives the example of imperialist intervention in Russia after 1917, when they could all agree on the need to intervene, but not how to collaborate fully, because they all feared that one or the other would gain an advantage from the situation, and they couldn't have that, you know. And eventually what you saw was the reactionary wing of the German bourgeoisie came to a deal with the early Soviet state and helped it build its army, you know, in order for them to gain an advantage, or they hoped for anyway, you know. And the ultimate example was World War II and its lead up, when both imperialist axes tried to gain advantages over each other, and they did so by collaborating with their class enemy, that is the USSR, to defeat the other faction. And as it's well known, the US-led allies came out on top of the Third Reich by such means. You know, Seymour cites the famous meeting actually between Hitler and the French ambassador Coulombre at the beginning of World War II, where both agreed that the war would likely lead to a workers' revolution. And they personified that by saying that Trotsky would be the winner, you know. And that was quoted by Trotsky in defense of Marxism. And Seymour quotes other examples, such as parts of the US bourgeoisie undermining sanctions against Cuba in the early Castro period because they could make good profits from trading in sugar, you know. And Seymour generalizes it in this way, and his argument is actually completely orthodox Marxism. I actually quote him here. He says that the issue was This issue was first quoted, was first posed sharply in the Marxist movement by Kautsky's theory of ultra-imperialism that held that competition between imperialist nations could be peacefully mediated in the same manner as competition between domestic monopolies. Lenin countered that the bourgeoisie cannot transcend national interests and that inter-imperialist agreements can only be based on the existing balance of strength, which all parties are desperately seeking to change to their advantage. We can see this incapacity to overcome imperialist capitalism's national basis today. I mean, the nearest thing to transcending national boundaries that's ever existed under imperialism is the globalization of the world economy since the collapse of Stalinism. Now, of course, Seymour had no knowledge of that when he wrote this essay, which was in 1977. It was well in the future. US hegemony, which suffered some decline in the 1970s, actually, over Vietnam and defeats like that, actually massively expanded after 1991 and the collapse of the Soviet bloc to produce this globalization phenomena. But now it's being torn to shreds by right-wing populist movements that reject most of its nostrums. I mean, migration is one key cutting edge. The populists, when they're not fascists themselves, which to me some of them are, will ally with fascists over opposing migration. You know, but there are other such cutting edges. The collaboration of imperialist states in wars that many of the nationalist-minded factions regard as being of dubious value to them has become a target, and you see nationalist opposition to the Ukraine war, which the populist factions see as a project of the globalists. That's a classic example. If this is not correctly understood by the left, we risk being disarmed in the face of this. The right-wing forces that are opposing the UK UK proxy war are not progressive. They're not our allies, as some on the left think. You know, they're simply reasserting the indissoluble collective connection of imperialist capitalism with the imperialist nation state and rejecting globalization as in effect a deviation from that. So the likes of Trump and Farage and Le Pen and the German AfD and Salvini in Italy, etc., are our strategic imperialist enemies. And any resemblance of what we say to what they say is entirely superficial. I mean, our job is to provide an internationalist alternative to them in opposing the wars of the other faction, not to conciliate them. Our job is not to unite with them, but to independently fight against the imperialist wars and proxy wars that we face in order to tear the masses away from these nationalist factions and win them to an internationalist position. And that's crucial. And I'll leave it there. I'll open it up to discussion. Thank you, comrades. Cheers. I hope I didn't go on for too long. Right, who wants to speak? Marie, you're muted though.
I say a few words then, since nobody is coming forward. It's quite a complicated subject. So thank you for the introduction, which I think is very good. I think that what I have learned here is that the bourgeois class is not to be understood like we understand a person with intentions, with memory, with analysis, and with tactics and so on. It has these things, but it has it in the context of being a series of interests, partialized, compartmentalized, so to say, atomized interests, which come from the functioning in the economy through competition. And even though they are making multinationals, you still get that repeated at the level of multinationals. So it doesn't make any difference. And so the importance of that is that when we in the struggle, we envisage, we try to foresee what capitalism is going to do or the bosses are going to do, we should not confuse the class, the bourgeois class with the behavior of a person. We should not believe that it can reason, for example. The bourgeois class doesn't reason. And the example you gave about the meeting between the French and Hitler that you gave Ian, this is interesting because there was two ruling classes which were foreseeing that the outcome of revolution would be, or the outcome of the war would be that Trotsky would win. Trotsky, it's necessary to remember, had counted on all this, and he had foreseen, of course he could not be completely sure, but he had foreseen that when in 1938 he said millions of revolutionaries will shake the earth, heavens and earth. He was talking about the end of the war, and it happened. Trotsky had foreseen, obviously there could have been something to change the direction of that foresight, but he had given the general idea that from the contradictions of capitalism, we could and we were going to overcome capitalism. And capitalism itself, when the capitalists met each other, Hitler and the French, Coulanges, whatever his name was, when they met, they knew that that conclusion was right, but they could not do anything with it because they represented a class, the bourgeois class, in separate and incapable, separate parts incapable of collaborating with each other. Of course, you couldn't expect that from those two, but it is even at the best of time when the capitalists move as they did in 1918 against the young revolution, the young Russian revolution, they were all intending to do the same thing, which was to overthrow the Bolsheviks. And eventually they had all these countries involved, and they couldn't make it. I think part of this is explained, therefore, in this document, which is very important that we are studying. And it's important to apply it ourselves. Otherwise, one gives to the bourgeois class much more power than it has. I think that the conclusion, a lot of comrades draw the conclusion that we are all going, if there is a war, we're all going to be killed. I think this is giving grossly exaggerated power to capitalism. They have all these weapons, and they have the most devastating weapons of history. This is true. But at the same time, they also have the greatest and grossest incapacity imaginable. You can see it in the way they can see that what they are doing in Gaza is just rebelling the whole world. It's getting the whole world mobilized against them, and yet they cannot do anything else. They don't have another way to go. And they can see that what they say is not true. They say we respect the law, and at the same time they break the law, like they did with the ICC and the International Court of Justice and all the treaties they've signed. They are lawbreakers. And well, they cannot do anything else. They know it is wrong, but they say, "Well, now you haven't seen properly. This is not what I am. I am not what I look like." And unfortunately, it takes a political functioning. It takes people like us getting together and discussing this to actually to become conscious and aware of the force that we have, because the capitalist system as it is obviously not sustainable by any standard of observation, and therefore is going to come to grief in some way. And therefore we have to learn, I think, to use these contradictions between them. They are incapable of unification of intelligence to actually take action, even in their own interests. And you can see that at all levels, including in the country itself, internally. Well, just to finish that here, I think that the role of that Russia is playing in Africa, it's at the moment, and in China, it's a little bit in the way of using this historic incapacity of capitalism. Russia's it has not a completely communist or disinterested interest. But the role that it plays, and in playing that role in the contradictions of capitalism, it is obliged to itself become part of the advance against capitalism to overcome this incapable and monstrous creature that is imperialism. And in that process, I believe it's being changed. Russia and China internally are being changed. Yeah, that's what I want to speak more later on. Yeah.
Certainly, yes. Who else wants to speak? Paul.
Hi. Yes, I enjoyed that. Actually, I thought that was very good. And I thought it was impeccable timing as well, because recent events have rather brought out various kind of conspiracy theories. And I don't know if some of you saw earlier, but I made the comment, if only we conspiracy. That's a reference to the fact that something that Marie alluded to, and that is that, and the essay did as well. It sort of gives the impression that these people are supremely intelligent, and they've made these plans beforehand. And I really don't think it's like that. And so I found the essay quite useful because it's a reminder that the ruling class. And I prefer that term to the ruling elite. Ruling elite implies that they've got special powers that the rest of us don't have. But it's a reminder that the ruling elite is not a body making all these secret plans. It's a reactive thing, and of course, and of course, it reacts according to national borders and so on and so forth. So I think that was a very good essay. And yes, there are attempts to by the ruling class to unify and consolidate their wealth in terms of globalization. But as comrades have alluded to it previously, over the last few weeks, the global ruling class is not united, and that's a reference to this idea that some people believe we're heading towards one world government and that kind of stuff, and I think that's nonsense. And if it were, we might well all give up and go home and cry ourselves to sleep. But thankfully, I don't think that's actually the world works. So for that reason, and the essay and Marie's comments that followed, as well as your talk. Yes, I think it's a very good session, and I welcome it. Thanks.
Cheers. Who else wants to speak? Plenty of time for discussion. We can probably carry on till about six if people want, you know.
I'd
John.
appreciate it
John,
if.
can John come in first and then you, Susan?
Oh,
Yeah.
apologies.
Well,
You
if you
can
can
go
come
in
in first,
first if you want.
doesn't really matter which way around, actually.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say about, this thing, the ruling class I might apply the term clever on the whole thing, but, you know, let's not underestimate them and what they've done, because, you know, they've done a pretty good job in many ways on the working class and on the middle class. And, you know, to think, you know, that they're completely stupid, or, you know, thing is not true. They're, you know, I mean, in Britain, they've done a hell of a good job, because a third of the working class have always voted Tory. Now, if that's not a good job, I don't know what it isn't. They've contained the workers' movement in this country, like nobody's business, into a... They've kept the middle class on board for large parts of their rule. And, they've got a very close relationship and history with both the middle class and the working class. You know, the very fact that, you know, there's been no opposition amongst any working class. In fact, it was very well done in the film Jaws. The Spielberg's film Jaws, because what Spielberg was saying in that film, partly was Quint, the captain of the boat, was the American working class, and the American working class had failed to stop the Vietnam War. All he's interested in is little boat and controlling that, and fails to catch the shark. And that was a metaphor for the failed American working class. And we mustn't ignore these things. And it has been the work of the bourgeoisie, which in the imperialist countries especially, who've done this very well. Although there might be a band of
validate the fact that we don't need a basis, that there doesn't need to be any merit to these claims. What we're seeing here in Florida is a preview to Project 2025.
Well, one of the things that I think is interesting in terms of themes that emerged out of a lot of the racial unrest that we experienced post George Floyd and during that very, very tumultuous period in American history.
Somebody's got their radio on.
People had the power, particularly in urban centers.
Hang on, let's see if we can rectify this.
And judges and people in the judiciary.
It's gone. What's happened? Carry on anyway. Sorry, John, you were talking.
No, I was just
found out by somebody's radio.
The bourgeoisie might be a band of disunited brothers, as Marx called them, but you know they've been pretty effective at facing off working class opposition and creating. The middle class that's sort of hugely attached to the bourgeois state and that sort of thing. That's the point I'm making. And, I agree with a lot of what was said in the talk about them not, you know, about the way they operate. But the fact is they've stopped any sort of socialist movement in the imperialist countries.
Who else wants to speak?
Yes, very quickly.
Susan wants to speak, sorry, yes.
Yeah, it was just to ask Max if he'd like to elaborate a bit more. I would agree with him on the dismissing conspiracy theories. For me, is just a way of stopping debate on issues that should be debated and that need to have clear thought and evidence about it. And without it,
shit,
we in effect allow other people to set the limits of what we can and can't talk about, what we can and can't think about. And in the same way that just because the ruling class appear to be successful, that doesn't mean that they are doing so because they are cleverer than us. It's because they cheat more. So, you know, I would be very interested to hear what Max has got to say. And then I, if you don't mind, I'll come back to how I feel about some of the things.
Certainly, yes.
If you're okay with that, Max?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I missed something, whatever I was. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, yes, yeah.
I missed whatever. I had to reboot because I was about to try to speak, and then my computer did something weird, and I had to reboot, and I lost about 5 minutes or so. And when I came back, got it back, I heard you saying Max, something about Max.
Anyway, Microsoft.
I don't know what you were saying about what I was trying to say, and I wrote a lot. I tend to write a lot in the chat sometimes.
You wrote quite a bit. Yeah, in it's chat. Just like what I asked you to expand on it.
Mm-hmm. Right. You kind of like asked me, what am I saying? And I'm going to try to tell you. So in my experience, at least in my intellectual life, politically, inside my head, really, mostly these days, and just watching and, you know, not really. I'm saying that because I've kind of reverted into my own head in the last few years because the left has kind of disappointed me. Not the left, but the groups that I might try to be active in, which is like so much not achieving anything. But I'm still interested in ideas. But it's not like. Just trying to say, from where I'm coming from now and the period we're in now, I'm finding myself, since I'm not allied with any particular, I'm not a member of any particular party, but I'll read, you know, this is the reason I'm in this meeting, even though it's past my bedtime, because I'm trying to talk to the people who are coming close to what I believe, and what every once in a while you find, even this group, like, what I'm trying to say is when people like Jimmy Dore or Joe Rogan or all these, or Glenn Greenwald or Aaron Maté and the Grazer, there's a journalistic aspect to it. It's not just like, I'm saying this because I'm not sure if your group did this, but I've read things from other Trotsky groups where they try to like write it off. They try to write off these people. And these people aren't like, it's almost like, they're treating them as if they're other socialists who've got it wrong when these people are kind of like journalists or show business. But the point of, with what's going on with journalism, where we have even mainstream journalism has deteriorated, like it's hard to find any kind of truth. So in that context, I don't want to be like immediately dismissive where I've noticed this for years. I was doing this myself in the past. Where we're just right off like, oh, he's got this one thing wrong, so that means he's got it. Well, not necessarily. You know, like you talk about the World Economic Forum. Yes, sometimes it is tied to some crazy version that doesn't come close to social. But there are some truth in that. And we have to – that's what I was getting at. It's like I was – even the term conspiracy theory itself is problematic, depending on who's saying it to who and where they're coming from, you know, and, you know, because it can go both ways, you know, it could be in the context of liberals and so-called conservatives. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is I found some truth in some of these people and what they're saying, because mostly it's a platform where they have lots of different people coming on and talking and they're allowed to go on and on. It's almost like a substitute for the fact that mainstream media doesn't have any objective reporting. So it's like, this is what we have now. So I don't want to dismiss it and just put myself in a box where I can only agree with some narrow, you know, thing. Like in the old days, it was Spartacists. And I know, Ian, we have this in common that we both were connected to the old Spartacists. And in context of what the why I liked the Spartacists in 1980 as a young man, because I understood why they split from the Socialist Workers Party, and on principle, I didn't realize they were actually in the process of degeneration then, because I was very young. But in retrospect, I see how they degenerate. But still, it was part of our movement. And but I just don't. There's an aspect to our movement, let's say in general, or my fellow tribes, because I'm also a Dalianist, where they tend to dismiss. My comrades tend to dismiss. I have disagreements with attitudes of even the comrades that I most closely agree with, and I don't want to say this to be offensive, because I think maybe I'm right, and I have very few venues to express this, but it's important to say this. Like, I don't know, you see what I'm trying to say? It's like they're not always wrong, those conspiracies, like the stuff about COVID. These are very specific issues, and not everything's about the class struggle, but anyway, I don't want to go on and on too much. I'll let you maybe, if you want to talk about something specific. I think I'm on to something here. Let's put it that way. And I'll shut up, because I tend to, I'm not the best speaker in the world.
That's okay. Okay.
Susan and then Mark, I think, because I think Susan
has... I think COVID was interesting because... looking at it 3 or 4 years down the line, we are looking at what may well have been a completely dishonest experiment on human health by Fauci and by others in Big Pharma, who thought that they could make a huge amount of money. The fact that it happens to vaguely resemble a Mission Impossible 2 plot is neither here nor there. But what it has exposed to us as workers is how easily a great proportion of society accepts authoritarianism when they are confronted by what might have been mortality. And the fact that the early COVID was quite damaging, but later versions of COVID, as it, shall we say, for want of a better word, the virus degenerated into less and less dangerous forms, which is something that happens with viruses anyway. We watched its economic and its other forms, and how much harder as workers it was to get back, if you like, our rights and our freedoms. But at the same time, an awful lot of people will have found an advancement in freedom, because it revealed the ability of many office workers not to have to work 5 days a week, 9 to 5, not to have to be corralled into offices. A lot of them found that they weren't spending half their lives commuting. All sorts of things allowed us to wriggle free. And yet at the same time, we're now, to use Paul's ruling class, we are being corralled back into our pens at various points. You've got the middle class, middle managers are distinctly unhappy that they do not have the power to oversee people if they are not in the office, and that people quite rightly push back against, they don't want to be watched on their computers all the time, although I think metadata will do that. So there's this constant fight between when is it a conspiracy theory and when is it an actual trend that certain groups of people can see complete advantages. You see that particularly in, shall we say, migrant workers, where people were brought in to undercut workers' wages. And when that didn't work and they didn't want the migrants to stay because they did, they then outsource. Only the imperialist powers now are finding that all the weapons, materials and other things that they've outsourced have now completely screwed them, because they can't carry out their imperialist wars. The classic one being America doesn't make its own gunpowder anymore, I believe. Is that right, Max?
I don't know I don't know about.
I do look it up. The last.
I don't know, but you know, there's a lot of. There's a lot of people.
Have you sent me a friend invite?
Oh, okay.
No, I said, have you sent me a friend invite?
I don't know. Who's this? Susan?
Susan McCrow-Hill, yes.
I probably have. I don't, on Facebook, probably. But I don't even trust Facebook. It's not that I'm
paranoid.
No,
well, that's it. I don't, which is why I haven't accepted it yet.
But yes, I probably did. If you see one from me and you want to talk to me, you can hit okay. I think we already are. The reason I don't trust Facebook doesn't mean I don't use it. I just use it, you know.
No, I use Signal.
I'm a little more careful about what I type on there than I used to be because, I've changed a lot about these issues in the last, let's say, 4 years. I'm actually believe things now that I'm surprised that I didn't believe 8 years ago because I've thought of myself as a Marxist, socialist, Leninist, et cetera, you know, for decades. But it's like you live through a period of history, and also there was a conscious element on my part, over the last 15, especially the last 10 years, to try to get reinvolved, like joining DSA, just so I could try to say, okay, I don't agree with them, they're reformists, but I'm saying that from the outset. I got to get in there. It's, you know, certain influences made me think, you know, maybe you could work from the inside. It was actually like those IMT group type people, you know. What do they call them? The Grantites and the Woodsites. And it was like entryism. But I'm glad I did it, even though I didn't achieve anything except that I met some people. But I really feel that these people are like DSA, you know what DSA is, right? Democratic Socialism America. It's good that I went in there and found out what I kind of heard for years and saw how thoroughly bad this organization is, you know. I'm glad they did it because I had to find. It's better to find out for yourself, is what I'm saying. The reason I'm saying this isn't just because of the details of me and DSA. It's because that what I've learned from, like, this attitude of find out for, you know, always, even when you're talking to your comrades, if something like doesn't sit right, because a lot of us have a tendency to want to belong to the point where we don't. Something's about what he's saying I don't agree with, but I don't want to, you know, I still want to be in, the, you know what I mean? I want to be part of the group or whatever. More like
Mark wants to speak. I think he's got his hand up.
Okay, yeah. Sorry, Mark. The point is to think for yourself is something worthwhile.
Yeah.
Mark.
I'm trying to really find the truth.
Yeah. It's surprising how difficult it is talking over something like this compared to actually talking to somebody's face.
Yeah.
I think conspiracy theories come about because there are so many lies. It just creates conspiracies because what else can people do? Nobody actually knows the truth about most things now. And as for the ruling class, it's hard to know who they are. If you take the Tory party, Conservative Party in Britain, I think they've got some fantastic people in the back rooms telling them what to say. All the sound bites and all the clever quips and stuff that the left never seemed to have got hold of. Things like constantly saying the same old thing like crystal clear and stuff. It's absolutely fantastic. The Labour Party tried, but not to the same effect. So I think it's the people in the back rooms that have got all the power, because when you look at a lot of the Tories, like Braverman, for instance, they're actually quite, considering she's had a fantastic education, she's a lawyer and she or something, she's actually quite stupid. And some of the things she says are quite stupid. And she seems that a lot of them are totally out of their depth. And I think that's because a lot of it's their background, the poor little rich people that have been brought up going to dinner parties. And then they go to Eton and then they go to Cambridge and they're dumped straight into running a country. And it's absolutely crazy. So I think it's actually the civil servants behind them that are the real brains and the real power. So I think that's all I've got to say on that subject.
Well, I'd certainly agree with you, having sat through a lot of Southwest TUC regional committee meetings, that the quality of civil servants is way better than the middle class managers that I came across.
Yes.
So Marie wants to come back in, if that's all right with comrades.
Yep.
Okay, Marie. You're muted, though. You're still muted. Still can't hear you, Marie.
Sorry, can you hear me? I want to come back a little bit to what we were talking about, because it is true, it has got many applications to general life and to everyday life, but one needs to keep a little bit to it so that one can see a bit more what use one can make of it. For example, the question of Cuba, I liked the comrade who said about Cuba, if it is deformed, I think he said, it's not deformed in a way which is identical to other deformed worker states. And this is calling for attention, because there came a time when, after the Russian Revolution, the bourgeois class, the imperialist class, they made sure that they were going to prevent something like a Russian Revolution again. They changed everything about everything they do to try and put barriers to anything like that again. And so the revolution took different channels. And it seems to me that Cuba was the one least to be expected to become a worker state. And yet this is where it happened, because it's where the bourgeoisie, the bourgeois class, was not imperialist. Batista was not an imperialist. He was crushed by American imperialism, and he was being used by American imperialism to turn Cuba into a brothel. And so the people there, it happened, found the created guerrilla. There's plenty of guerrilla struggles throughout Latin America and the world, particularly Latin America in those days. And they made a war which was a guerrilla, which became, with the working class of the sugar cane, became class, because the idea of nationalizing the land didn't come from the guerrilla struggle. It came from the communist experience, and that communist experience was communicated by the working class. And so Cuba developed in a way which was completely different from Russia, and it is as if humanity had found another way to build a worker state. It was now a nationalist revolution. In the beginning, it was a national movement for sovereignty against the United States, national sovereignty, the defense of sovereignty, which meant the expulsion of the United States. And in that process, it meant also the overthrow of all the friends of the United States, which was the landowners, and therefore you had to nationalize. And in that process, there came the ideas that came from the Soviet Union, which and then had come from Cuba as well. Don't forget, this is come from China. This is after China. And so all these ideas which came from the world were implemented. In that process, Castro was for a long time defending democracy. And then gradually could see that if he really wanted democracy, equality, he had to expropriate the few, and there had to be a plan for production for the many. And so he was taken in a dynamic which changed him. He started off as a bourgeois democrat, and he ended up as a communist. He created a communist party, the communist party which had come from the Second International, the Third International. That communist party of the Third International fought him with weapons. And in that process, he saw, and Guevara saw, that the communism of Soviet Union was not enough, and they were looking for another. They were looking for another way, and there was no books on how to go from feudalism, which is what it was, feudalism, over to the worker state. There was no manual, and Trotsky was not acceptable in those days in those milieus. And so they built a worker state, which was never really properly a worker state, and yet which was not degenerated. It was not fully developed, and it was not degenerated because it never was generated. And so it seems to be the formulation of Posadas, you know, the Posadists were involved. The Posadas said it is a sui generis revolution, it's a sui generis worker state. I think this is important because it shows that we don't have to repeat automatically the models of the past. There's going to be new ways, and there's constantly new ways. And particularly now, the Nazism is on the rise, but not in the same way as before. And I think we should come back to what Ian told us about how the bourgeois class is incapable to go beyond the national, its national conception, the conception of the national state, the national concept. It cannot go beyond this. And this is where I believe we should go back and demonstrate that this is where capitalism is going to fail. Yeah. I've finished. Yeah.
Can I come in just a few minutes, just make a couple of points? I mean, on Cuba, I think what you said is very interesting. But I think a number of people have made points about the different nature of Castro and, say, Stalin, you know. But of all the deformed workers, I mean, there are several different, there are different subdivisions of deformed workers states that were created after World War II. There were the ones in Eastern Europe proper, the Glacis, or what they called it, the People's Democracies, that were basically transplanted Stalinist hacks from, who were in exile under Stalin in many cases, to become the leaders of communist parties that were pretty much under control of the Soviet bureaucracy. You see that in East Germany, you see it in Czechoslovakia, in Hungary and other places. There are other types of deformed worker state where a native guerrilla movement was the main locus of creating the state. There is an earlier example, there are two earlier examples than Cuba. One is China and one is Yugoslavia. And they were very different in themselves, you know. They both were created by native guerrilla movements that were not under the control of the Soviet bureaucracy. But exactly what those states were is difficult to define. They were both created by communist parties. This is the point. They called themselves communist parties. They were part of the broad movement of the degenerate Third International, even if in many cases they rebelled against direct Stalinist control, as both Tito did and then Mao did. You know, they did not do as they were told, but they operated in a way that was broadly within the framework of socialism in one country, albeit socialism in their country. And they didn't they were hostile to the idea of world revolution and of consciously seeking to spread the revolution to other countries, particularly the advanced imperialist countries. That hostility was built into the Communist International, and it didn't simply depend on Stalin. It was a programmatic change, I would argue, that took place over a period of several years in the 20s and early 30s, and it became consolidated. And I think the thing about Cuba is, yes, I mean, you mentioned the Posadist group in Cuba, who were important. They were the main opposition to the Trotskyist group in Cuba at the time, weren't they? They were the main, the dominant Trotskyist group in Cuba. But what happened is when they tried to produce Trotsky's works, they were the plates were smashed and they were imprisoned, you know, by the early Castro Guevara regime. They had sort of realized, although the regime was not bureaucratic in the big sense, they behave bureaucratically towards the Posadas group, who actually attempted to give this a conscious dimension. And they put them in jail, and they stopped them from printing their stuff, and they actually physically smashed the printing presses, or the printing plates of Trotsky's Permanent Revolution, as I understand it. And yes, I mean, there are various opportunists in the American SWP who are absolutely infatuated with Castro, who denounced the Posadas group as ultra-left and said, oh, it doesn't matter what happened to the Posadists, because they were just ultra-left lunatics. And they didn't understand the real revolutionary nature of Castro and Cuba. And that was a terrible error. That was the error of Joseph Hansen and the American SWP. And that was what, you know, the Spartacists actually at the same time in the United States were waging a battle over that in the SWP, along with Tim Walford, actually, who was the founder of the Healyite group, He wrote the original document on called Cuba and the Deformed Workers' State, or something like that, which is, if you read the Spartacist little pamphlet, it's quite a big pamphlet, actually, called Marxist Bulletin Number 8, which is Cuba and Marxist Theory. The main initial document was written by Tim Walford, who became the Healyite leader in America, who completely dissociated himself from what he'd done. And it was an excellent document. And he completely denounced it later, which is such a tragedy, you know. But I think there was a lot of commonality about these things. But the Sparks themselves were flawed, you know. It's a shame. It could have been the basis for a regroupment and bringing together of a broader, more, you know, capable and effective Trotskyist opposition. Instead, it fragmented into little sects, unfortunately. Just on conspiracy theories. I mean, I think the point, conspiracy theories are quite difficult to define, you know. But if you start, my view is that if you start to imagine a scenario that really is beyond the capabilities of human beings, almost. If you start imagining that a particular force is omnipotent and can do, you know, is in some way capable of doing things that are beyond what we would normally expect any collective of human beings to be able to do, I think you're on the wrong track. And I think that some of these things, I don't know about this Fauci stuff. I mean, there are so many different partial experiences of the COVID pandemic. It's not all been worked out, in my opinion. I don't think that COVID was a conspiracy. I don't think it was a biological. It may have been a biological accident, but I don't think it was consciously put together for sinister purposes. I think it was a natural disaster or a semi-natural disaster, possibly a byproduct of research that went wrong somewhere. But it was effectively a natural disaster, and it was nothing. It was very difficult for the bourgeoisie to handle, and they handled it badly, you know, very badly in some cases, you know. But I think it is several years behind us now, and things are not the same, but they're not that different either. You know, the class struggle has resumed in slightly different circumstances, and we're facing the same issues today. It hasn't fundamentally changed things. So I'm dubious about the view that COVID was some sort of unique event. I don't think it was. As I said, there was a pandemic after the First World War that was far, far worse. But that was because there was the modern medicine that exists today did not exist then, you know, not in the same to the same extent. It was very much in its infancy. And many more millions died. That may have happened if COVID, you know, speaking abstractly, if we hadn't have had the facility to produce the means that we have had against it. I know people who've died of COVID, and I know people who've died of bloody of a bad vaccine as well. I know both, you know. So what do you say about that? It's two sides of the coin, isn't it? You know, COVID was terrible, really was terrible. You know, but some of the vaccines were very not good either, and not just talking about the Western ones either. I'm talking about Chinese vaccine was a bloody, what's it called, Sinovac. It was absolutely awful. It paralysed people for months.
Hang on. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sinovac was not absolutely awful, but the Americans absolutely hated it because it was Chinese.
Well, I know family members.
I'm not saying I know a lot more than you, but I have researched it a lot. And like Diana, I have a good background. I can't agree with you on any of it. And yes, we have regularly suffered from pandemics. The World Health Authority is one of the places that we were no better at coping with COVID than we were with, you know, the Spanish flu, which I'd rather call the Kansas flu, since that's probably where it originated, but that's another matter. But the reality is coronaviruses can do that. There are bioweapons in the world. Horton Down is a classic one. We know that there are manufactured illnesses. The real issue at the moment are the ones I talked about, which are how did we respond to the authoritarian, you know, the attempts to try and give us vaccine passports? How did we respond to the attempts to try and make it so that everybody was going to have to be vaccinated every year in perpetuity? But it is certainly true that, you know, and poor old Faraz, if you know him, you know, kept saying to me, Susan, it's got a Furan cleavage site. It is almost certain that that was manufactured. And it was almost certain that it was done in order to make profits out of it. And that can be told by the fact that worldwide, it was the West who suffered far more in the way of deaths. It was, you know, China dealt with it with isolation and exactly the same way that originally that was how America and Britain had to deal with it in the 1920s. But there is an awful lot about COVID, as you say, Diana, gain of function and the research. And there wasn't just research in the Wuhan lab. There was research in dozens of labs. There was even research in the bloody Ukrainian labs that the Russians took over. You know, and it is, and that's not conspiracy theory. That's documented evidence. It's a bit like that. You know, Russiagate, there are real things out there that happened and there are not real things that never happened that people are convinced happened. And that's the issue is, you know, it's not a conspiracy theory when there are facts to support it. It's not, it is a conspiracy when people believe it, when there is no evidence whatsoever.
Mark.
Yeah.
Yeah, COVID, my partner was coming home from a care home where they were all dying, dressed like a spaceman at first. We didn't know what was happening. And I've got to say, I mean, I worked at a place that had a vaccination centre. I had lots of conversations with the medical staff. They were desperate. But what I will say is as soon as they introduced the vaccine, certainly the deaths in the care home stopped and a lot of other deaths stopped. But The figures we're looking at is in this country, I think it was over 200,000 people died from the virus or something, wherever it came from, I don't know. It's supposed to be possibly an American laboratory near China or something. But slowed deaths down straight away. You'd still got people with long COVID and you'd still got people not taking vaccines. And I think the people that died from vaccinations compared to the people that died from COVID was next to nothing. And yet those people are still ranting on about how dangerous vaccines are. I've actually had three because I worked at the place and nothing's happened to me. I just think sometimes drugs are going to have reactions on people. Even aspirin can have a reaction. So I think that that was basically it. And sometimes it's a bad reaction, yeah.
But the thing we have to remember is also £37 billion was spent on Radox and various other companies to give us all those vaccines. You know, the tests. Now, the tests were the biggest money spinner out. And, the doctors will tell you that not everybody who tested positive for COVID had it, because that particular test was so flawed. And not everybody who had COVID came out as positive and were told they didn't. But if I tell you that 200,000 people died of COVID over that 2 or 3 years, but 90,000 people a year die of austerity in this country alone, doesn't it put it into perspective? You know, we are not sitting there saying, oh, yes, we've got to fix austerity. We've got to make sure children get free school meals and breakfasts. We've got to pay third child benefits.
Somebody's dropped off.
As Diane keeps saying, good health, good nutrition, those are the things we need to stay healthier. What we're doing is saying to Big Pharma, well, it's all right if children go to school hungry, because we'll just give them a jab a couple of times a year and we can charge that to the NHS. Why waste the money on giving them food?
Yeah. Anyway, who wants to speak now? It's an interesting discussion. There's no doubt about it. I mean, it could go on for a long time. I don't know. Who else wants to speak? I don't want to spend all the time speaking about this necessarily, but...
No.
The problem is we've got another... It's half past five.
I hate to be boring, Ian, but can you define who you see as the bourgeois class?
The owners of property, on the owners of capitalist enterprises in the main, you know. Some of them are financial. In today's capitalism, particularly in the advanced countries, it's become more financial enterprises, because industrial capitalism has declined considerably. But it is basically the owners of capital who gain their wealth from the exploitation of workers and the appropriation of surplus value, which is the value that the workers produce above the value that they are paid, the price that they are paid for their labour. That is the basic orthodox definition of what the bourgeoisie is. It's a class that gets smaller over time, you know, because you get the concentration of capital, you get mergers. It's a natural process of capital. It's why capitalism becomes more and more top heavy, more and more monopolized. And there is a process also where profit rates begin to fall over a long period, because capital becomes more concentrated and the amount of technology and actual physical capital investment increases relative to the amount of labour that produces the value. And so you get this long-term tendency of the rate of profit to decline. So
the reason I ask is, we have a society now where an increasingly large number of the academic, you know, university trained, skills trained, professional classes can no longer buy their own property. You have people who are left two houses by both parents, and you get people and have live in one and rent out the other, who I presume you would regard as bourgeois. But you also have people who own, you know, who happen to live in who work jobs. I always look at it as, you know, if you lost your job, how long would it take you to be thrown out of your accommodation? There is a sense of entitlement and privilege that says certain groups of people don't see themselves as bourgeois, but are. You know, I when I was first starting to look for jobs, I'd said to somebody, I was introduced to a guy and he said, oh, you know, I'm a stockbroker. I said, well, how did you get into that? Oh, well, I came out of the army and I just looked up a couple of my friends and they said, would you like to come and join our stockbroking firm? And I'm going, boy, do I live in the wrong world. You know, this is the bourgeois world I see. It's the nepotism and intrigue and the groups of people who do not have to worry about where the next meal comes from if they do not have a job.
Can I just make one point about that? I mean, I think that you just talked about two different things there. You talked about that situation where somebody has got connections from the army or, you know, who comes out of the army and
family
inducted through various networks of pre-existing, actually, into stockbroking. That's one thing. But you also talk about people whose parents have got two houses and whatever, you know. I think those people are not the bourgeoisie. They are part of the petty bourgeoisie, but they are not the bourgeoisie. Whereas what you're talking about in the other case is, does impinge on the bourgeoisie, the owners of big capital, you know. And that's what we're really talking about. We're not talking about somebody who's got an extra house who rents it out. That is the petty, that is part of the petty bourgeoisie. That is an intermediate layer between the two main classes, you know. I think they're a bit different. Obviously, the petty bourgeoisie is often ideological cannon fodder for the bourgeoisie and is capable of, you know, organising in political movements like the Tory Party, the Liberal Party, even elements in the Labour Party, who they will do the bidding more or less of the ruling class in various different ways, or at least they ideologically tend to be camp followers of the ruling class. But they're not the same thing as the ruling class, you know. And that's the layer that if we get a strong workers' movement, we can pull those people away from the ruling class, you know, essentially, you know, because they really are not bound to them by, you know, by firm and indissoluble material ties. They are privileged, but they're not that privileged, in other words, you know. And they could be. You know, persuaded to take the opposite position. You know, but I think those are worth considering. Anyway, that's what I would regard
Thanks.
As my
Thanks, definition. Ian. By the way, Paul's got his hand up. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, Paul. Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah. On that point, in terms of obviously, yeah, people who actually own their home and so on, and they use them as homes. Yeah, that's a different scenario. But so in that case, what would you call people that had own properties on the buy-to-let market? is that petty bourgeoisie or even in fact bourgeois, or does it depend on the size of the operation?
Yeah.
Sorry?
I said it probably depends on how many they've got.
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought of the petty bourgeoisie is a smaller scale type of the bourgeoisie, isn't it? They might think they're the part of the bourgeoisie, and they might share the same ideology in the way that they talk about things and the way that they think, but they are, like you say, they are different, aren't they? It's, you know, petty bourgeoisie, it could to be, some people might think of them as working class in some respect, but shopkeepers, for instance, I mean, I would say they were petty bourgeoisie, but some people might even say they were working class. I mean, shops are actually quite complicated because you get organisations like Londis, that is a big chain, but their business model is where it's basically a franchisee. So the person who owns that shop runs it as their business. Mm-hmm. But I suppose Londis is just the supplier of their goods and so on. But it can get quite complicated when you talk about the bourgeoisie and the petty bourgeoisie. And of course, these days, we've got an added layer of people who are technically self-employed, but they're not really. And that can add complications to it, can't it? Anyway, thanks.
So John wants to speak.
Yeah, I mean, this question of people who ran out of properties, I mean, what for me is underlying this question is not so much, they're not part of the bourgeoisie, the ones you're talking about, the petty bourgeois, but what's the underlying question for me, and has been in a position I've held for many years now, is the question you're asking is, right, in imperialist countries, right, do sections of the working class and the middle class benefit from being an imperialist country? And the obvious answer is yes, they do. And what you're talking about properties, is one of the ways that they do benefit from being an imperialist country, right? Because, the property boom has mainly been in the imperialist countries. And people... And no matter what the SWP and groups like that say, there have been a material benefit for those people in the property boom. And that's what's underlying some of this discussion about who owns the property. Because, in the imperialist countries, people are more likely to have those sort of advantages and to take advantage of them and to build up a bit of wealth and capital. And, it's seen in the, what's interesting, it's seen in the, what do they call it? The, bank of mum and dad and all this sort of thing in that. Right. That they're able to pass on their wealth and help the younger generations of their family establish themselves to some extent. I'm not saying everyone, but to certain sections of the middle class and working class, and that's a phenomenon. Obviously, they're not members of the bourgeoisie, but they're members. But there is a material. There are material advantages, and these are passed on, and property is one of the ways.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, just on that, very briefly. I mean, I think the point I was making was about there are people who won't. Yeah, there might be a person who's got one house that they rent, got one extra house that they rent out and get extra income on. On the other hand, there might be people who've got 10. I think there's a difference in quantity and quality involved in that. And those people are aspiring to, they have climbed up into, if they get them in, I knew of somebody who was in that position, a very unpleasant character. And I won't go into the details here, but reactionary stuff about immigration and abuse of migrant people and whatever came into that story, But I think, you have someone in that position has a lot of power. But I think that's a different situation to the family who's got an extra house in the family because of various quirks of their family history or whatever. I think that's a different situation. That's someone who's running this stuff as a business in a big sense. That person is. Those people are entering into the ruling class. Or at least that's their objective. They are on the lower rungs of it, as it were. I mean, yeah. they might not be the same as the higher up, but they are seeking to do. Sorry, Mark wants to speak.
Yeah, I was just going to say, surprisingly, I'm a landlord, but what happened to me is my parents died, I moved into their house. I decided to rent my house out to make up my part-time wage. So it's a very low rent for a family. And now it's time to sell. They've decided that they're okay about that and they want to go into a council house. But to cut a long story short, the council are holding us up because they say I need to be aggressive with them and serve a Section 8 before they can even consider helping them out with a council house because they've got a dependent. So not all landlords are exploitative. And to be fair, it's cost me because I've charged a low rent. But I do know people that rent out lots of places. But landlords are always condemned, but we're not all the same. I don't like being a landlord, by the way. The house will be going soon and I'll be glad to get rid of it. It plays on my mind being a landlord. I don't like it.
No. And I agree with you. If you are a considerate landlord, you are left with exactly that issue of, do I charge the rent everyone else is charging? Yes, which is exploitative because at the moment most rents are way above what leave people with something to live on. Or do I try and be nice to people, in which case I have to live on less myself because you haven't got the money to give away. And it's always going to be difficult. But I'm really talking about when I first went to university, the first thing somebody said to me was, oh, well, of course, you're not working class anymore. You're middle class because you're an academic. And you just went, what you mean? I've suddenly stopped being what I was, which was being condescended to by a bunch of people because I went to grammar school whose parents obviously were much wealthier than I was, because there is nothing worse than being working class and condemned with more brains than you've got to know to keep your mouth shut.
Okay. Anybody else? Should we think about winding this up? It's 10 to 6. Unless anybody's got something else substantial they want to say, of course. I mean, you can go on if you want. But does anybody want to say anything more on the topic of the broadly related to the to this point on the agenda? Anybody else want to speak?
Yeah, I'll speak. Again, find the raise your hand button.
Yeah, sure.
My computer's messed up. I just have to speak because I can't find the raise your hand button. This thing is messed up. I got a shitty computer. It's a Chromebook. What I wanted to say was I read the article that we're supposed to be talking about yesterday. I don't know. I read it real quick just so I'd be prepared if I managed to. Some of it I kind of wanted to read it again, but I realized that I think I typed this in before. I'd seen Seymour back in 95 when I was trying to push my father and his second wife. I was trying to like sway them toward the Spartacists kind of thing. I don't know, politics. Anyways, this big thing, it was a debate. And it was kind of strange, but I remember Seymour was yelling at Mandel. And at the time, Mandel, I think, was close to death. So it was a long time ago, but part of me, my father's wife, who was kind of liberal, I don't know, she's never really understood Trotskyism. I was trying to like push her to understand Trotsky, but it didn't work because the way it looked on the surface was it made Seymour look like a bully yelling at this old man, even though I more agree with, the side that Sparts were, and I'm against Mandel. In this particular instance, just the way it up made, kind of made, if you don't really understand the arguments. Anyway, that's just something I add that apparently, I guess he was a shot in the, part is this, but reading the article is like, hey, that's the guy. I had to check this while I was right before I came to this meeting. I had to look up Seymour and make sure it was the same guy I saw it was. Some of that article's confusing. The only encouraging thing about it and good thing about it was it reminded me about how the point that I did glean was like this idea that like somebody said before, it's not an individual. The bourgeoisie is not like a person who reasons, and they can't rise above nationalism. It's almost like automatic pilot. It's like it's almost hopeful in a way, you know, even though in a bad way. It's you know, even though it's like objectively or just living it, you feel like, geez, we've been struggling for this for decades, and we never achieve revolution. But then it's nice to be reminded, you know. Oh, I can't find the word, but there was something in there that was like, you know, don't give them too much credit. You know what I mean? They're still just people, you know, they're kind of like compelled to do things because of their history and economics, just like all of us are. And, you know, it just reminded me of the basic underlying thing about Marxism is that objectively, sooner or later, you know, the masses are going to, if we can get it together, we have such a majority that we don't even need half of us to take over this world and make a better world. And there's something in that article that reminded me of that, just to like,